Welcome to the Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over our training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. We talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress.
And today we have Mike with us. Mike lives in Eastern Washington, where he works as a performance coach, specializing in sports performance for combat athletes, and also as a physical therapist, two in one. Mike has also competed in pro MMA and is a BJJ black belt. Fabulously fabulous bio, Mike. Tell us a little bit about your work.
Sure. So, well, right now I'm in a kind of a weird spot because when I say I live in Eastern Washington, literally I moved like 5 days ago. So things are kind of up in the air. The work that I'm consistently doing right now is I do like a virtual sports programming for performance for combat athletes. And so it just depends on what type of athlete. But with combat athletes, it's, you know, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, kickboxing, mixed martial arts. But really, it's just kind of like, how can we optimize the person, right? Because a lot of combat athletes are either behind the times or kind of foolish with their training methodology. So it's like, how can I optimize them from a joint health perspective, from a strength and conditioning perspective, from a training organization standpoint? You know, a lot of times these combat athletes just want to go hard as possible, but they don't realize that that's not necessarily our goal. Our goal is to make you do the best, and going harder doesn't always mean you're going to do better.
Okay, you might have to break that down a little bit because I I think most people feel like that. Yeah. Like, and unless you have the experience and the know-how. So can you just break that down a bit, how not going hard is not always the best idea?
So it really depends on your goal. So the first thing when I'm working with someone is we want to see what their goals are. So some people are more recreational athletes, and if they're more recreational, obviously we have more of like a general program, whether it's focusing on strength, conditioning, joint health, or whatever they reach out to me for. You know, but let's say I'm dealing with a competitive athlete. So the goal is for them to peak at the point of their competition. So how do we get them from when they contact me to, you know, their max sports performance? So, you know, we'll take example. We'll start with conditioning, right? So a lot of times what people want to do is they think that they need to just go really hard and just really exert themselves. But you have to think that when we're doing conditioning, there's different aspects of cardiovascular training that we're trying to achieve, whether it's from an aerobic standpoint, whether it's from an anaerobic lactic standpoint or anaerobic alactic. So aerobic, people don't realize this, but for combat sports, for the most, it's an aerobic-based sport with intermittent bursts of submax activity, right? So, you know, whether you're grappling or striking or doing both, for the most part, because it's going for a period longer than 2 minutes, your aerobic capacity is really, really important. But people always think that they have to do the explosive stuff. So we kind of want to do a combination of those things. So we can look at, from a conditioning standpoint, what are they lacking in their current training? And in a lot of cases, people lack doing the necessary aerobic training, which will supplement, improve their performance, you know. But then there's some people that, you know, like, especially jiu-jitsu is a good example. Like, I can do jiu-jitsu because I'm a black belt, and I don't necessarily need to go into those upper levels that, like, maybe I would if I was wrestling. So, like, if I'm, you know, dealing with a jiu-jitsu athlete, they might need to do more on the other end, where it's, you know, a lot of sprinting, high intensity, but with the goal of full recovery. So we either want like max 100% output, or we're using it as recovery. So we do something and then we're trying to recover as quick as possible and do it again. So it just depends on the goal of the athlete and whatever adaptation we're looking to achieve.
Okay. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And also, yeah. I guess, like, if you're constantly going 100%, you're more likely to get injured. Is that also one of the things that you have to go into?
Well, yeah, so it's there is injury, but then there's a concept of overtraining, right? So you can't just go 100% every day. You need to kind of taper it, because as you go harder, you're obviously, your muscles are getting beat up. You're also draining your central nervous system. So it's like you're kind of, you're if you keep doing that over and over again, you're not going to get the physiological adaptations you're looking for. Like, it's like, let's say you're lifting weight. Like, you can't just do your 100% one rep max every time because your body can't sustain that. So maybe we do, you know, high intensity strength work, you know, once or twice a week, because again, when we're dealing with like strength and conditioning, the goal of my clients is the combat athlete. So they don't need to be strong for a power lifter. They need to be strong for a martial artist. And those are two distinct things. And that was something that I ran into a lot of trouble when I was coming up, because, you know, the general idea is that if you want to get strong, you have to do powerlifting. But I was also trying to train 4 or 5 times a week. So like if I lift as if I'm just, all I am is a powerlifter, and then I'm also doing, you know, like another 10 hours of martial art training on top of already doing the powerlifting, there's going to be a point where something's going to give, whether I can't get the strength adaptation or I can't, you know, do necessary skill training. I think that's what a lot of athletes don't realize, is that like when I'm doing martial art training, my goal should be skill development, skill building, not just like conditioning, right? Because, you know, like, again, if I'm training, I can't necessarily guarantee that I'm going to be working in the ranges that I need to during skill training, right? Because my goal is, like, if I'm doing jiu-jitsu, like, someone's on top of me trying to strangle me, like, my goal is to not get strangled. Vice versa, if let's say I'm the one on top, I don't want to just use unnecessary energy, because that's not efficient. Like, the goal of martial art, whether it's jiu-jitsu, striking, boxing, wrestling, whatever, should always be efficiency, and then that way you can use, like, conditioning as a supplement to our skill building to really build the optimal athlete.
Mm. And since you've mentioned jiu-jitsu, what are the common injuries that you've seen as a professional?
Oh, okay. So the you know, according to research, the most injured joint is going to be the knee. So, you know, so it's going to be like various knee injuries, you know, meniscus, ligament injuries. I would say like minor ligament sprains are probably the most common. You know, unfortunately, the traumatic injuries like the ACLs happen a lot too. Elbow is a pretty common injury just from, you know, getting armbarred. So it's called a UCL strain, which is, there's a ligament on the inside of your elbow, which is going to get essentially stretched during an armbar. So those are like the two like main areas that are going to be injured in jiu-jitsu. Again, but obviously, you know, there's other injuries. People hurt their neck, people hurt their back, people hurt their ribs, etc. But, you know, if you look at the literature, that's the most common. A lot of injuries in jiu-jitsu, they'll be either traumatic from like a, you know, a joint lock or a scramble, again, knee injuries. But then there's also a lot of overuse injuries. Again, back to jiu-jitsu athletes just kind of like wanting to go like really, really hard. So like a lot of times people are going to have like a, some kind of like elbow tendinopathy, like a golfer's elbow or a tennis elbow. And that's just because if you're doing like a lot of gi training and you're also doing barbell training and you're squeezing all the time, like, again, at some point that elbow is going to get too beat up. So that's a pretty common injury as well.
I might sound very lazy and trying to cut corners, but is there any way of preventing these? Is there any exercise that will protect our ligaments then?
So again, the there's no like magic exercise that will prevent injury, right? But we can mitigate it. So if you look at literature, the most common type of thing that will be best for protecting a body is going to be strength training. Again, it's appropriate strength training to supplement your sport. But if you think about it, right, so like a lot of injuries, you know, so a certain amount of stress will go into a tissue, whether it's muscle or ligament. And the stronger that tissue is, the more stress it can absorb. So when we're doing martial art training or exercising, we stress it a little bit and then it adapts and can get stronger. You know, if someone applies a joint lock, they're applying a lot of energy into that tissue, and eventually, you know, if the energy surpasses the capacity of the tissue, bad stuff happens. So the answer is, the general answer is strength training, but then we could be more specific, and then we can do joint strengthening exercises. So I do a lot of exercises from system called Functional Range System, which is really focused on joint health and like maximizing the health and the resiliency of a joint. Because again, if we do, you know, combat sports, you know, we're just putting a lot of stress on those joints. So how can we keep them as strong as possible? And what that means is we want a joint that can do what it needs to do. It has the necessary mobility, so there's a little bit more of a buffer when it goes into those ranges. And then when it is put in those ranges, do I have the absorption capability at those end ranges? So even when, like, again, my arm's extended, can I at least, you know, are those tissues prepared for that stress, as opposed to if I've never put my body in that position, the tissue will be unable to deal with that stress because it's never had to do it before. Right? Mm-hmm. That makes sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. Do you incorporate that sort of joint protection work within your strength training that you do? Do you do it at the same sort of time? Can you bring it into your conditioning?
Absolutely. Yeah. So like a general way that I would, like, again, like a very brief way of I do my programming is, first we do some kind of isolated joint movement, then we can do joint priming, which would be this end range isometrics, then we can do like more loaded movements or more compound movements related to whatever our goal is for the session, and then we would do our strength building, speed building, muscular endurance building, whatever our goal is from there. And again, that depends on the athlete and what we're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And you've recently made a post about the spine.
Yeah.
You made a spine, no. About the spine and grappling.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through the key points about that?
Sure. So if you think about the spine, and unfortunately just the nature of martial arts, especially jiu-jitsu, is it's a flexion based sport, meaning bent over. Now, if you look at a lot of literature, there's been a lot of concepts of maintaining a neutral spine. And the idea is that the spine is this flexible rod that, you know, the muscles, your abdominal muscles, your erector spinae, so the back muscles and your side muscles will help stabilize it. And that's where the spine is most stable, right? In that neutral position, because then those muscles can kind of help stabilize. When you're in a neutral spine, you can use your diaphragm to create interabdominal pressure. Again, that creates stability. The problem is we're not always going to be there in athletics. So like if I was going to do a deadlift, the more stable I am, the better, because at least I want to stress the spine less so I can use the rest of my muscles to accomplish the lift. But if, you know, like I'm doing jiu-jitsu, like my knees are going to be to my chest, I'm going to be like kind of rolled up. I can't be neutral, right? So what we want to do is we want to, you know, for jiu-jitsu, we want to make sure that we have the capacity for the positions we're going to be in. So the cervical spine, there's 7 vertebrae, so essentially 7 joints. So the thoracic spine, there's going to be 12. The lumbar, there's going to be 5. And then you have the sacrum, which is kind of a fused joint. So that's like 20 plus joints, if you think about it. So we want to make sure that each of those vertebrae has the capacity to move. Because a lot of times when people throw out their back, what they're describing is like a spinal buckle, right? So if, let's say we take the lumbar spine, the spine is 5 segments. If 4 segments don't move because you're really stiff and 1 moves, when I'm put in position, that 1 segment's going to be doing everything, which means that it's going to get overloaded. So from my goal when I work with people is I want to make sure that every segment has the capacity to move, right? Because again, if strength is the best thing we could do to absorb force, I need to make sure that I can first control and move a segment. Because if I can control and move, then I can start to actually build strength. Because if I can't move, then I can't actually do something to strengthen it. Mm. So there's a concept of creating spine segmentation and creating this awareness to make sure that every segment has the capacity to move. Then I want to make sure I can achieve global movement. And then I want to start achieving like kind of this end range stability. So if I'm rolled up in this awkward position, that I'm able to be okay versus, you know, like, you know, if I'm put in a position where I can't really go, that's when bad stuff happens. It's like in jiu-jitsu, like we can look at like inverting. So like we kind of like roll upside down. That's not a dangerous position if I have the capacity to do so. The problem is a lot of people don't have the capacity to do so because their spines are super stiff. So when they go in there, they end up hurting themselves. So You know, so a lot of times, again, for combat sports, is I have to make sure that I can get in those positions. Then we can translate for striking. For striking, I have to make sure I have adequate trunk rotation, right? Because when I throw a strike, I'm loaded up and I rotate. So same concepts apply. I have to make sure that I have good rotational capacity so that I have a wider range of motion to generate force to, you know, upon impact, just get all that energy.
Yeah. And if your spine is too stiff, does that lead to a problem like a slipped disc that some people get, or like a trapped nerve?
Well, it can, right? Because if I can't move, so the slipped disc would be the spinal buckle I talked about, where the disc doesn't actually slip. It's just like it feels really painful at a certain spot because that one segment's forced to move too far. Then the muscles say, hey, you move too far. I don't want you to move too far. So then they seize up, and that's why people really can't move. Then we can say like a pinched nerve, whether it's like kind of a disc herniation, right? So again, if we overload the spine, what will happen is eventually there's the disc, the intervertebral disc, there's kind of this inner portion that if it gets stressed enough, it can start to press out on the outwards, which creates that bulge, which then can compress on a nerve, right? And so I'm only really concerned with herniated discs if they're pressing on a nerve. Again, a pinched nerve could be that if there's less space between the vertebral segments, so when that bulge happens, it presses on the nerve, and obviously that's problematic in a different sense.
Mm. Mm. And moving on from that precious Instagram post to another one that we loved, about cervical stiffness and absorbing head strikes. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So obviously when we do any type of striking sport, we're going to get hit in the head. Mm. And, you know, the when we get hit in the head, it puts stress on the brain, and that's how concussions happen. So I can build this into, you know, concussions too. Actually, I'm going to take this question. I'm going to jump into concussions, and then I'm going to come back.
Oh, lovely.
Because it makes it a little bit easier.
Lovely.
So if you look at literature, what are the ways that we can avoid a concussion? So a concussion typically is a rotational acceleration of the brain. So, it's not like there's like an older idea where that they thought that the brain was hitting the skull and that was what was creating the concussion. Now what they're looking at is when that brain kind of like accelerated rotates, it will put a shear force on some of the brain tissue, which then kind of they damage the neurons, right? And so what happens with the neurons in the brain is when they're somewhat compromised, it kind of sends an influx of calcium ions. So it kind of throws off the whole neurotransmitter. And so now the brain isn't able to do what it normally does because it's in this like metabolic crisis. So what they found was that the best way to kind of protect the brain would be threefold. One is vision training, meaning that if I see a strike coming, I can brace accordingly and I'm fine. But it's usually the strike you don't see that's the problem. So first I have to make sure that I can see the strike coming. Then I have to have appropriate reaction so when I see it, I can actually respond and brace. And then I need sufficient neck strength so when I do see the strike and I brace and I'm hit, can I absorb the blow, right? So that's kind of like where neck strength comes in. So there's some evidence shows that the stronger the neck is, it can reduce concussions. Some say it's kind of inconclusive. And the reason why is because, again, if you can't see the brain, you can't see the strike, doesn't matter how strong the neck is, because if I don't see it, I can't brace, and then I get hit, bad stuff happens, right? So now we'll progress to cervical stiffness for absorbing stress. And again, so I see the strike coming, I brace. Now I have to make sure that I'm stable enough so that when it hits me, it doesn't create that rotational acceleration, which I'm worried about. So again, I have to make sure that my neck can absorb the blow appropriately. And I'm going from a stationary target. For the most part, my neck isn't moving and something's forced. So I have to make sure it's strong enough so that when it does hit, I can at least absorb enough so it doesn't cause those you know, bad stuff that happens when you get punched in the head.
Yeah, for sure.
Sorry, you said that the literature says that it's inconclusive on if the neck is strong, it can protect against head strikes, and that's because because there are some head strikes you can't see, but for those you see, if you have a strong neck, does that make it better then?
Correct. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's why it's hard for me to say get your neck strong to protect against concussions, because the answer is not that simple.
Yeah.
But even if some people are like, well, we can't conclusively say that having a strong neck is great for concussion, which again, there is some mixed evidence that there is. For a combat athlete in general, we need a strong neck anyway, because you know, if I'm a grappling athlete, I'm gonna use my neck for things like when I'm doing like a blast double. I have to make sure my neck's strong enough so when I bash somebody with my head that I don't hurt my own neck. Or like if I'm doing jiu-jitsu, like a lot of times like I'll use my head as kind of like a fifth hand, right? Because I put my head down so I can base. So there's a lot of reasons why combat athletes are going to want to get a strong neck. You know, again, even if you don't think that having a strong neck is going to help with concussions, there's a lot of reasons. So I still would err on the side of get your neck strong to help protect it as much as possible for strikes. But, you know, like I said, I'm going to, add the caveat of what the literature says. Yeah. I actually was thinking about trying to do kind of like a research study on this. The problem is mixed martial artists are terrible for research, because like what makes them successful as mixed martial arts means that they're generally not good on like following schedules and being on time. So I'm like, all right, I need you here at this time. They generally don't do it. So that's the only problem with that one. So, a good way to describe it is it's like herding cats. Like it's just really difficult to work with, MMA fighters.
Absolutely. And I think it's so, just touching on the strong necks. I mean, I know that when I don't have a strong neck, like I can, you feel like if someone's ever got you in a choke or something, it just feels like they're going to rip your head off. So it makes sense just for the whole sphere to sort of have a really strong, because it's the top of your spine, isn't it? And your head's super heavy. Yeah. So it sort of makes sense to sort of give that as much strength as possible.
Yeah. I mean, I like you say yourself, like what other sport do you have so much trauma to your neck, whether it's impact or just like people literally strangling you? Like, there's no other sport where the amount of stress is going to be on your neck as you would like a grappling. So absolutely. Like having a strong neck is going to minimize that wear and tear of getting strangled and choked day in, day out for years at a time.
Absolutely. And just one more question about concussion. What's the aftermath of a bad concussion? Can we just talk about the symptoms? Because I think, and are they different for men and women? Because I don't know if they are.
That's a good question. So I don't think there's necessarily a difference in the symptoms based on men and women. It's going to be, so what happens is, so I talked a little bit about the physiology. There's essentially a metabolic crisis. So what that means is your brain has a hard time doing what it's supposed to. So there's going to be like sub-classifications of concussions. So for some people, they're going to have like an exercise intolerance, right? Because as they start to exercise and their blood, kind of like their heart rate increases, the brain can't really tolerate that. So a lot of times those people are going to have problems. Then there's going to be like a balance issue. Then there's going to be something, it's going to be like your vestibular issue. So, which is sort of with a balance, but it's going to be your visual ocular reflex. So, but the ability for my eyes to kind of follow things. There's some people that are going to have like kind of a mood. So their ability to like handle emotions is going to be altered because their brain is in this kind of a altered state. So there's different ways that concussions will affect people. For the most part, most symptoms in an uncomplicated case should resolve within 7 to 10 days. That's not always the case. There's a few things that may make someone more predisposed to having like more of a prolonged concussion. Like some people that have a lot of dizziness, they tend to have a more likelihood of having a prolonged concussion. But I think a really important case or thing to keep in mind that a lot of athletes don't know, and this is important for coaches, is you might not have a lot of clear concussion symptoms to 7 to 10 days. That doesn't mean that your brain is ready to take more stress. Because again, when you have a concussion, your brain is in this metabolic crisis. It can take somewhere between 21 and 28 days for your brain to be able to handle stress again, right? So there was kind of an interesting study where what they looked at was that if you have a concussion and then you go back too early and you have a second concussion when your brain's in this vulnerable state, that second concussion is like tenfold worse. So that's the kind of the worry. So I have a friend, and I could talk about this because a fighter that he coaches talked about it in Joe Rogan. But my friend Chris Holdsworth, he was on The Ultimate Fighter. He won it. So he's a phenomenal martial artist. Like, you could talk to some of the current UFC guys that he trains with right now. Like, he's really, really good. Like, very skilled fighter. But what happened was, while he was in the UFC, he had a concussion during training. And then he went back a little bit too early, got a second concussion. And I don't know how long he was out for, but I think he had concussion symptoms for like 3-4 years. By the time I met him, he had gotten back to training, you know, and now he's doing well. And now he's opened a successful school in Northern California. But it ended his athletic career because he went back too soon. And I think that's, you know, for the athlete and for the coaches to know. You know, so if you look at after a fight, that the physicians will have a mandatory no contact, which is, in a lot of times, it's 30 days. That's because there's no clear-cut way of saying your brain is ready for getting hit again. So in a lot of cases, we'll say no contact for 30 days. So it kind of gives you that buffer, because we know that 30 days means that if let's say you had a concussion on day one, a concussion, you know, you get hit in the head that would result in a concussion on day 31, that for the most part, that second one would be essentially a second concussion versus an additive concussion, right? You know, there are some things that you can do, because just because people feel good doesn't necessarily mean that they're ready to, handle stuff. That's why, you know, the UFC and with some of the athletes that I'll do is I'll do a baseline test, so that I know when they're at least back on, you know, back to true 100%. And essentially that would be like a balance test. There would be kind of like a visual ocular test, so I can see how well they can move their eyes. Then we can do like a neurocognitive test. So there's this program called IMPACT, and it's like it's this computer test that you can follow, and it's this speed-based kind of like cognitive test. So it can look for, have you kind of like resumed your current level? But again, to have a really good assessment, you need to have the baseline, because we have to know where your baseline is and where you are now, versus if you don't have the baseline, the test isn't going to be as good, because, you know, some people might be sharper, some people might be a little bit slower, and that's just them, versus, you know, what is actually causing the brain to be in a diminished capacity because of the concussion.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, I guess you have to be a coach who's seen your athlete through.
Yeah.
You have to know them, so to be able to spot the different signs.
Yeah.
Is there a chance that you'd be just in training and getting little concussions? Can you get a little concussion regularly and not know? And then does that build up to some sort of bigger issue?
I don't think so. Again, that's a good question. So people say, like, how many concussions you can get. And from everything that I've read currently, I don't think there's like a number. I think what happens is, do people recover adequately between concussions? So again, people get rocked in training and they don't know any better because they're trying to be tough, and the coach says, get back in there. Because if you've been a fighter, you don't want to say, no, I can't do it, because again, you're admitting defeat. So a lot of times, fighters going to get hit, they're like, no, I'm good. And trust me, I've been there. Or like, I'm going to say, no, I'm good. The coach needs to say, no, you're not. You're done for the day, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the important thing. So it's those things where people might have a concussion and not realize, because they're trying to be tough, and then they get the second concussion. So I think it's super critical for people to take brain health seriously. And if you suspect you have a concussion, go get checked, go get assessed, give it some time before you get back to contact. Now, I think a lot of people don't realize, when I say no contact, that doesn't mean sit in a dark room for 30 days. What that means is don't get hit in the head. So based on if you understand the sport or what your activity, there are things you can do based on what phase you're at. Like, you could be doing conditioning, you could be doing strength, you could be doing skill training. So there are things you can be doing. So it's not like you're just sitting doing nothing, but it just don't get hit in the head. Mm. I think that's the key thing.
Mm-hmm. So good that you're explicitly saying do not get back to, basically, do not get back to sparring, right?
Correct.
Okay. with your wisdom, can you now tell us a little bit of a list of do's and don'ts on training around injuries? Because what you said was spot on. People generally in martial arts, not just mixed martial artists, in general in grappling, when they're training, they want to toughen it up, and they want to go in as soon as possible, or their life is like is incomplete without training, so they rush back without actually being 100%. So any do's and don'ts in those scenarios?
So again, this is obviously general, because you know I have to be. So we'll give people general advice, right? Yeah. And by the way, I do work with people on that, because since the athlete doesn't know, they can consult with someone like me who understands both the rehab side and the sport on what's safe. But again, you know, so we have to define the different types of training. So we could be doing kind of like technical drilling. We could be doing like a flow roll, like true flow roll. And a lot of people don't know how to flow roll. But again, it's non-competitive, you know, a slower pace. You could potentially pick up the pace, but you're not like actively fighting or resisting. You're kind of, again, you're flowing. And, you know, when it comes to jiu-jitsu, I think that's like a really important ability to flow. And that's like, again, even though I'm a black belt, I don't have active students. But one of the things I would say is if you're going to be like a purple belt in jiu-jitsu, you should be able to understand how to flow, because you should have the technical ability to not just try to smash people. But again, you know, in a perfect environment, if it's local, I would be the one that they would be flowing with, because I can flow and I can tell them what to do. There's also positional training. So depending on the injury, there might be some positions that you can do. There's certain positions you might not be able to do. So again, based on the injury, positional rolling might be fine. Then there's light rolling from the knees, and then there's full rolling with takedowns. Usually wrestling is going to be the most difficult to get back to, just because it's really hard to flow wrestle. If you watch like a lot of high-level wrestlers, the way that they drill is like a very active way of drilling, which is almost their way of flowing. But like when it's time to actually go live, you really can't do like light wrestling. It's either you're competitively trying to take them down or you're not. So, and then we could look at striking. So with striking, there could be, you know, shadow boxing, there can be hitting the bag, there could be hitting the pads, there could be partner drills, and then there also could be then progress to sparring. So again, so we look at we could define the different types of training that people can do. So one of the things I'm looking for when I'm working with an injured athlete is, do they have the movement capacity to do the positions that they need to do? So a good example is, let's say someone has a knee injury. Can they fully kneel, right? Because you're going to be in a position where if you're sitting in someone's closed guard, you have to be able to kneel. Whether you're playing butterfly guard and someone's trying to aggressively pass, whether you're trying to sweep them, I have to make sure that their knee can get in that position without pain. So if I can't kneel and I'm in someone's closed guard and they try to sweep me and my knee doesn't go that way, that's going to be a big problem, right? If I'm trying to play butterfly guard and someone collapses me, that's going to be a big problem. So, you know, that's an important one, is can we kneel? You know, if we're dealing with like a back injury, I have to make sure that people have the ability to kind of like essentially do like various rolling. Like, can you just kind of rock back and forth? Because if you can't do that, like, and someone starts to stack you, like, again, it's going to be bad. You're going to hurt your back more. So first we have to make sure we have the moving capacity for whatever positions we're doing. Then I have to make sure that they can handle the speed, right? And that's something that people forget. So there's both in training, there's the speed of training, and then there's the predictability. So with like light flow rolling, we might be going low, like kind of like a low speed, but it's fairly predictable because I'm not actively fighting. Versus in like full rolling, I don't know what that other person's going to do. Even if like for me as a black belt, like I'm rolling with a spazzy white belt, they just do weird kind of dumb things because they don't know any better. So you have to keep that in mind. So like maybe I'm dealing with a knee injury and it's unstable. So I have a ligament strain, an MCL strain, you know, so I don't necessarily want people to put my knee in a position. So it's essentially like I don't want my knee to be pushed inwards. So those are people where, you know, I'd say, hey, if you're going to roll, like you can't aggressively fight a sweep. If someone sweeps, you just have to take it. Those are people I'd say maybe you don't do standing guard passes, because just the way that a lot of guard, whether it's De La Riva, reverse De La Riva, or like various like leg entanglements, like they could put stress on the knee. So just kind of stay away from that. You know, an important thing I look for like any kind of upper extremity injury would be like, so it doesn't matter if it's shoulder, elbow, or wrist, but it's the concept of basing, right? So if I'm passing, someone sweeps me, I have to put my hand out and make sure I can support myself. So if my wrist can't tolerate that, I can't straighten my elbow, or my shoulder's unstable, again, when I base out, if I don't have the capacity to base appropriately and someone throws me there, it's going to be problematic. So those are just kind of like some important tidbits of things you have to be cautious of. You know, and again, when I'm working with an injured athlete, I build in return to sport testing. So for like the upper extremity, I can do like various closed connect chains. So like push-ups, single arm, you know, like kind of like plank holds, or there's other tests that you can do. But essentially, I have to make sure that they can handle that and I can compare to the unaffected side, right? Because for the most part, we can assume that if someone had like an injured arm, that likely they're as strong, it was as strong as the other arm. So I can kind of do some of these tests as kind of like looking for like limb symmetry. And again, if we see that there's like a big difference, then I would say maybe you're not ready because you're still in pain, it's still healing, you haven't regained the issue. Because what people don't realize is the most common risk of injury is a previous injury. And what that translates to is a injury that wasn't properly rehabbed. And jiu-jitsu people are really, really foolish about this. They're like, my knee hurts and it's swollen. I think I can roll. No, you can't. Like, it's not ready for it because it's swollen, you don't have the range of motion, and it's going to be weak. And I think people don't realize that until we, and I've done this plenty of times, but I put people in these various positions, they don't realize what the difference was until they go through the test. Like, oh, wow, like, this limb is a lot weaker than the other. You know, and then we can translate to like with like lower extremity injuries, whether it's like hip, knee, or ankle, we could do various balance testing. We could do like a single leg squat. We could do various jump testing. Even though like for jiu-jitsu, the ability to jump isn't important. For wrestling and like striking, where it's a little bit faster, you can see the translation. But jumping is like an easy way to look at power development in the leg. And again, if you can't develop power without pain or there's significant weakness, it's going to be harder for you to absorb that quick, sudden burst of stress.
Mm. I mean, and also with injuries, it's because there's, I think, it's good to, if you can, introduce movement, isn't it? Because I think there was a while, the advice was just to rest. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then now it's more about actually like moving it, you know, within your capacity, because actually getting movement brings blood flow, and that is just generally good. Is that
correct? 100%. So the best thing that we can do for an injury or joint health in general is moving, right? Like movement, because as you move, it brings nutrients, blood flow. So when people say rest, you have to realize, like, and that's why it's funny when people on Instagram, they always bug me. They're like, I have a shoulder injury. What do I do? The answer is always, I don't know, because I haven't assessed you and I can't give global information. And if you want global information, it's going to be general bad advice. So when people go to their physicians, their doctors, and they're like, I have a knee injury. What resting means is, well, right now it's aggravated. The physician doesn't know who the person is, and a lot of people are dumb. So what they say is just stop aggravating it. So again, that's why working with like a rehab specialist who understands the sport or your activity is better of saying resting just means stop aggravating the injury. There could be things that you can do that won't aggravate the injury. The problem is, again, you know, like you're not going to go to your physician who understands black, like, you know, jiu-jitsu. Like they're most likely not going to be a black belt. So they're just going to say, well, I don't know what jiu-jitsu is. That looks really hard and damaging. Just stop doing it for like 6 weeks and it's going to cover your bases, right? So, so that's why, you know, obviously I'm biased because I'm a rehab specialist who understands the sport. But if you have an injury, it's really good. And what doesn't matter whether it's jiu-jitsu or whatever, you know, working with a sports physio is really important. If let's say like your sport's tennis, like you should work with a physio who understands tennis because they're going to be the best at getting you back. Like I work as a sports physiotherapist, so I've worked with athletes who play all sorts of sports. And I can still do an adequate job. But with a combat athlete, I can do the best job because I know very, very well what they need to be able to do because I've done it. I know what, like, if you're like, I want to compete, I know what that means. I know what the intensity is like. I know how to get back there. So I think that's really, really important for, you know, when you work with someone, they can give you more specific advice on what movements to do. Because again, you know, I can say move, but if I don't know what the injury is, there still should be movements I don't want you to do. But globally, specific movement can be very beneficial for an injury or joint health.
Mm-hmm. I mean, something that I've really noticed is that, and you sort of touched on it with like a doctor, GP, just telling you to not mm-hmm. do anything. It's that GPs don't, they just, as long as you're well, they sort of, they just want you to not be hurt. Whereas you, as a jiu-jitsu practitioner as well, you understand the importance of actually recovering in order to be able to re-enter that sport. Because, and my best sort of health people in my life all were or are athletes. Because they get it. Whereas a doctor might just say, okay, just stop moving. And for an athlete to hear that, it's just like, that's not really an option. Exactly. That's like, it's not really going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think people don't realize this. And I didn't realize this until I got the medical field. Like your GP, your primary physician, their job is to get you to the next appropriate person. So like they kind of know a little bit about a lot of things, but again, for the most part, they're just saying, don't do stuff. But like as an athlete, that's not good enough. That's why you want to work with your physio, your rehab specialist, even orthopedic surgeon, because they're going to know a little bit better. Like I had a knee injury a few months ago, and I knew exactly what it was. But I still, it was unfortunately something I knew I needed surgery. But I still had to go through the channels of going to my primary care so I can get the x-ray, so I can get the MRI, so that I could go see the ortho. And like, you know, my primary care is pretty much saying like, one, that their testing was terrible. But two, they're like, oh, I think you just strained your knee. I'm like, that is not what happened at all. And when they saw the x-ray showed that was not the case. Like the x-ray, the MRI proved my hypothesis. But, you know, like they're just, because they have to know so much, they're not qualified for the specific stuff. So if you go to your primary care, your job should be, Get me to the next best person, whether it's a physio, the ortho, surgeon, who really understands what needs to be done.
Mm. And you as an individual needs to advocate for yourself. And
absolutely.
Say, no, this is actually bigger than you say.
Yeah. Because, it's a little, you guys are in the UK, so it's more, you know, socialized medicine. So like they don't want to send you to the ortho because that's going to cost them more money. If resting for 6 weeks addresses it, they'll just say, hey, let's just see what this does because it might respond, versus going to the ortho, going to the MRI because it might have been something very minor. So they don't want to spend the time and money. So absolutely, if you're injury, like advocate for yourself.
Hmm. And so you've worked, you know, you work with men and women. Are there any mm-hmm. differences in, I mean, there are definitely differences in how you adapt to strength and conditioning. Have you noticed differences in their injuries that they sustain?
I wouldn't say I've noticed a difference in the injury. I do notice that women tend to be smarter about dealing with their injuries. So men tend to be more foolish and they just don't address the injury, where I've seen more women combat athletes come to me because they realize this is a problem, I have to do something about it, versus the guys are trying to be the tough guy, like, oh, it's not that bad, I can handle it. So I would say that's definitely something I see. I don't really see anything else. Like, I haven't done a ton of research in looking at like kind of like gender differences between injuries. You know, I think it's fairly similar, but like I said, women are definitely smarter about handling their injuries.
Can I ask you a completely different question now? What is your opinion about tracking devices? For example, you know, I'm waking up, I'm looking that on my phone or on my app or whatever, that I haven't slept enough mm-hmm. and I'm about to go training. How, like, should you adapt your training to what the data is saying, or should you go with, I'm going to push today, let's see how it goes? First of all, do you use it? If you use it, it
means... I do.
Oh, you
I
do. Go on.
So I use a Fitbit to track my sleep, and then I use a device called Morpheus to track my heart rate variability. So heart rate variability is kind of like looking at your kind of like your central nervous system fatigue, which is one of the things we talk about, right? So there's some days where you feel really good. But again, for the overall, the system, you could be more like a sympathetic focused situation. So my body is still recovering from whatever I did. Or it could be more in a parasympathetic where I'm actually where I'm supposed to be in recovery. Now, we don't want to be too far in one direction. We want to be kind of eventually center. So the devices, you can argue how reliable they are, but I think the one thing that whatever device you use will be good at, if you use it for a long period of time, tracking like kind of like big differences, right? So like, you know, like I don't know if the Whoop is better than the Morpheus or which one's more accurate or how accurate a Fitbit is tracking sleep. But again, if you use it for a prolonged period of time, because it's the same device, you'll notice kind of like big differences. So what I would say is, depending how you're organizing your training, I think it can be helpful. So if like, let's say like your body's saying you're in a very sympathetic nervous state, you know, like your body isn't recovered, maybe you don't do like your max lift. That doesn't mean don't lift or don't train. Is maybe that's not the day like I'm like, I want to do max sparring. But I'm realistic and I'm a martial artist myself. So I've been there where I had a red day and I'm like, screw it. And I start rolling with like four black belts. So like people who are really going to push me, I've done it. And if like, let's say you're training for a fight and you have an 8-week camp and you do 2 sparring sessions a week. So that's 16 sparring sessions. Am I going to not do this sparring session? And again, that's something that you have to decide based on where you are in the camp. If you're feeling really terrible and you know, it's near the end of the camp, maybe you do want to skip it. But if it's early in the camp and, you know, it depends on the person. There's some people who will push through. Like there's some people that like I've had clients and friends who use these devices and they completely ignore them. Like they're always in the red and they're just going hard. So I'm like, well, why are you even tracking this data? Because they're not going to use it, you know? So it just, I say it's, I can't say, yes, you should skip the training because it kind of depends. I do think it is good to have the data. It's not necessarily needed, but it can give you, if let's say we're doing strength conditioning, maybe this is a day that you kind of like take it a little bit easier. Maybe you do more of a recovery workout than like I'm going to do like my max intense sprint workout.
Mm. I mean, that makes sense.
Well, when you're training on reds, Mike, doesn't that put you on a risk of injury?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. And that's something you have to be careful of. So, like, if let's say, like, you are a recreational athlete, like, you don't have a competition, like, do you need to train tomorrow? No, you don't. Like, again, maybe instead of, you know, doing like, you know, like competition style training, maybe you're doing more flowing, maybe you're doing more positional training. So as opposed, like you still can train, you're just not training at that same intensity. But again, like if you have a competition coming up, you have to make that decision and your coach has to make that decision of, yes, this is important for you to do this training session, you know, or maybe you're like, you know what, like based on how close you are to the competition, maybe this is one to skip.
Hmm.
Or alter.
And you mentioned central nervous system fatigue?
Correct.
Can you talk us through that? Because that's essentially what happens when you overtrain, and that's when you sort of, is that correct? And
yes.
You
just, yeah. So with overtraining, what happens is when we do some type of physical activity, we stress our body. Our body is, again, in a somewhat weakened state, but then in that process, our body adapts and we get stronger, whether we're doing strength training, whether we're doing like tissue building, whether we're doing cardiovascular training. I mean, that's just the law of biology. And if we don't stress our body will adapt negatively and it won't use resources to maintain or improve. Well, so what happens with overtraining is we stress our body and we don't rest accordingly. And then we stress it again and then we don't rest accordingly. And that's when our body is like, well, people don't realize is the adaptation's in the resting part, not in the stress part. So when I'm working with an athlete, my job is to stress an athlete as little as possible to get the adaptation we're looking for so that we don't just keep overtraining. You know, that's what, like, you know, that's what happens with a lot of people. They go hard all the time without adequate rest. And now we're actually going to have that negative response where now our body's not going to rebuild. It's going to start to go the opposite way. So central nervous fatigue is, you know, again, our body's ability to handle stress. And again, if we overstress our body, even from like again, central nervous system is our brain's ability. Because when we activate muscle, what happens is our brain sends a signal to the muscle and then that creates activity. So we don't want to overly stress that central nervous system because it's going to slow our capacity to kind of improve.
Yeah. And have you done any work with athletes who are recovering from long COVID?
I have not, actually. That's kind of an interesting thing. I've had a few teammates and training partners that would have it. I was actually worried that I had something because I told you it was a terrible time. I got COVID like 5 days before I was supposed to have knee surgery. So because I had COVID, they canceled the surgery and they moved in a month, which was really frustrating. But then I was getting like, I couldn't work out because of a knee injury, but I was getting these like weird like spikes in my heart rate. So it, like, I think it was like a temporary like myocarditis, but I went through, I had ECG and everything was normal. You know, that being said, I have not actually gotten to work with people who have this long COVID, but this myocarditis, which essentially is, I think, long COVID, is, you know, our heart tissue's not as well equipped to being stressed and adapting. So, you know, like, those are some people that obviously go through whatever cardio rehab channels you need to. But doing like low aerobic training could be a good way to slowly stress it in the proper way without overstressing your body.
Mm, it seems like slow and steady, basically. Correct. Like inch, yeah, by inch, which goes against most martial artists' sort of yes, mentality, absolutely, which is absolutely hard and fast.
Absolutely. Start swimming.
Yeah, wow, yeah. Well, yeah. Start swimming, just breaststroke. cool.
Before we finish, so we normally ask the last question, but Shanti had a really good idea of asking a very personal question before the last question, so that we get to know you a little bit more. And, you know, yeah. So tell us about a time in your life, any point, that you have failed and how you brought yourself back up. It does sound like an interview question for a job, but it's going to tell us a lot about you. So,
and it's very relevant to athletes, isn't it? Sure. It's sort of like we're constantly failing and then it's that build back up to next comp or whatever.
Yeah. So we'll look at competition, right? So I'll say, so I had a few MMA fights. There was one fight that if I had won, my coaches said, I think you're ready to go professional. So I took the fight. I lost. And it was, you know, when you train for mixed martial arts, like, because like you do this like 8 week camp or whatever, like you feel like your life is over because you just wasted like 2 or 3 months out of your life. You're like, what am I doing this for? Like, if I lose, how can I, you know, cause at the time, which was unrealistic, but I thought I could make actually a living as a mixed martial artist. So I lost. But you have to remember, like, one competition doesn't define you. That's not the most important thing. Like, unless the competition is like you trying to be the best in the world, whether it's like, you know, the IBGF Worlds or ADCC Finals, or like it's a professional, you know, like world champion fight. Like, it's everything you're doing is to prepare you to getting to that point. And if you're someone who competes, but you're not doing it for a living, you know, like, you have to remember that at the end of the day, like, that one competition doesn't define you. You can win, and it still doesn't necessarily, like, make you a better person. So when you lose a competition, I think it's super important to then evaluate what went wrong. Because were there things that I could do better in my preparation, or were there things that were it didn't matter. Like, you know, that's the thing with competition. It's not fair. You can be doing everything right. You can be doing, you know, putting all the work in. Your opponent could be putting nothing in correctly and they can still win. And that's incredibly frustrating because it that's not how it works. Like, you know, for sometimes like you're just the way things go, like you were going to lose. But assuming you can go back and there was things you could do, is what went wrong and what can you do better from a preparation standpoint, from a kind of like a in competition, was it a strategy mindset? So like we'll use this fight example. So even though like I was training for a fight, my specialty was always that I took a fight knowing that I had better jiu-jitsu than my opponent. So if it came down to it, I knew that I could submit them. They might have better wrestling, they might have better striking, they might have better both wrestling and striking, but I knew that if I had better jiu-jitsu, I can still win the fight. And what that happened was, is even though I've spent many years striking, I didn't have confidence in my striking. So, because like when you're training, you don't knock your training partner out, but I submit my training partners all the time. So again, that in my opinion, that submission was that checkmate versus like, again, you can't guarantee you're going to win on the feet. So I started the fight. I'm very confident in my closed guard, which is obviously not ideal in mixed martial arts, even though I do really well. He took me down, he beat me up a little bit, and I was like, well, my whole plan was to submit him from my back, and it didn't work. And I was like, so then the second round came, and I wasn't trying to actually like stop the takedown. Like I should have been focusing on like using my striking because I had a very big reach advantage. So like I easily could have I don't want to say I can easily outstrike the guy because I don't know, but I had the advantage in the striking department, but I didn't have the confidence that I did. You know, I did go for takedowns, and you know, there was one time where I had the guy's standing at his back, as opposed to like tripping him to get him to the ground. Like I just try to like leap on his back because I'm like, well, I need to get it. And then I slipped off and now I'm on the bottom, you know. And then third round, now I'm down two. I get the takedown and I'm thinking I have to finish this guy because I knew that I was down. So by being like really, really like aggressive with finishing him, he reversed me and anyway, I lost.
I'll come back.
But the big takeaway was that I didn't focus as much on my striking within the fight because I didn't have my confidence. But I also, I should have had from a competition, so it had a plan B, a plan C. So this was what my goal was. It didn't work. What's next? You know, like my most recent competition, I was going with this guy and I knew that I had better leg lock. So my game plan was pull guard, leg lock him. Everything was going perfectly. I get him in the leg lock position and he didn't tap. And now I'm like, shit, now I have to try to break this guy's ankle. And, you know, like, I kind of, like, paused because I wasn't ready. You know, his ankle popped a little bit, but he ended up getting out. But because of the first, which, again, that MMA fight happened years ago. The grappling happened, like, a few months ago. But, again, like, I've grown as a competitor since then. But I had a plan B. So, like, the guy escaped. He got a dominant position. I escaped. And then I swept him, mounted him, took his back, and finished him. Even though that wasn't the initial game plan, I had other things that I could do. I wasn't just like, this is the only thing that I could do. So, you know, I think it's really important to, whenever you have a competition, whether you win or you lose, you kind of review what went well, what went did it, so that you can grow as a martial artist. Because ultimately, again, if you're not a world champion, who cares if you win your competition? Like, you know, like, I don't want to like beat on anybody because like, I remember when I won like my amateur fights or like a blue belt competition, but like, honestly, like nobody cares other than you and your family. The goal is for you to become a better person. And I think that's an important thing you have to remember.
That's a really lovely goal. I think that's a really lovely takeaway because people do focus so much on winning a competition and then they win it and then they've got to win the next one. And it's not actually about their own personal growth.
Correct.
It's more about like checking it off a list or just sort of like having that as the sort of growth of your own ego.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank
you so much for sharing that with us. We've got our final question, which we ask everyone, and it's essentially what motivates you. But what we are women who fight, and our question is, what are you fighting for in your work, in your life? What drives you?
So I think I would say like my kind of like my professional goals are, I'm trying to educate the combat sport community. Like that's why I created my Instagram. Is it all came down to because I would get frustrated that people didn't understand leg locks and they'd be scared. But then I started obviously talking about other things and, you know, talking about concussions because people don't understand concussions. So that's kind of like my focus at this point, is to just educate people. Because like, I remember when, you know, I wasn't a physio and I had knee injuries, and thankfully, like, I was okay, but like, I had no resources out there to help. And, you know, obviously if someone comes to me and they have a knee injury, I can't answer their situation if I don't know what's going on. But I can still give like general advice on what do you do with an injury. What can you expect if you have an ACL tear? What will it present like? So you have the awareness of, I'm not trying to diagnose you on social media, but you're like, this is a bad knee injury. I need to go see my ortho, versus, no, this isn't that bad. This is something that will heal on its own. You know, like, what is a, I got punched in the head, versus like, no, this is a concussion. You have to go see someone. Like, I think that's the most important thing, is educate athletes, coaches, and just kind of like recreation people, like kind of like how they should, you know, take care of their body from an injury standpoint, from a strength and conditioning standpoint, from a technical strategy standpoint. You know, like, even though like that's not my specialty, I'm still a competitive black belt. So I do understand how they kind of all blend together. So, and because I'm a black belt, people will listen to me where they might not listen to like their average physio, even if we give the same message.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes from your experience. You know, it's very likely you've had the same injury.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Mike. That was so insightful.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Women Who Fight podcast. And credit to Will Grant for being our songwriter and sound editor. Please subscribe and share and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at womenwhofight.co.uk, and check out our website for more content.